Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. When Charles Bovary was 17, his parents sent him off to study medicine. Enrolling for his first term, the syllabus that he read on the notice board stunned him. Lectures on anatomy, lectures on pathology, lectures on physiology, lectures on pharmacy, lectures on botany and clinical medicine and therapeutics, without counting hygiene and materia medica, all names of whose entomologies he was ignorant, and that were, to him, as so many doors to sanctuaries filled with magnificent darkness. He understood nothing of it at all. It was all very well to listen, he did not follow. Still, he worked. He had bound notebooks, he attended all the courses, never missed a single lecture, but he failed completely in his examination for an ordinary degree. So Charles set to work again and crammed for his examination, ceaselessly learning all the old questions by heart. He passed pretty well. What a happy day for his mother. They gave a grand dinner. Where should he go to practice? To Tost, where there was only one old doctor. For a time, Madame Bovary had been on the lookout for his death, and the old fellow had barely been packed off when Charles was installed, opposite his place, as his successor. But it was not everything to have brought up a son and to have had him taught medicine and discovered Tost, where he could practice it. He must have a wife. She found him one, the widow of a bailiff at Dieppe, who was 45 and had an income of 1,200 francs. Charles had seen in marriage the advent of an easier life, thinking he should be more free to do as he liked with himself and his money. But his wife was master. He had to say this and not say that in company, to fast every Friday, dress as she liked, harass at her bidding those patients who did not pay. She opened his letters, watched his comings and goings, and listened at the partition wall when women came to consult him in his surgery. She constantly complained of her nerves, her chest, her liver. The noise of footsteps made her ill. When people left her, solitude became odious to her. If they came back, it was doubtless to see her die. When Charles returned in the evening, she stretched forth two long, thin arms from beneath the sheets, put them round his neck, and having made him sit down on the edge of the bed, began to talk to him of her troubles. He was neglecting her. He loved another. She had been warned she would be unhappy. And she ended by asking him for a dose of medicine and a little more love. One winter's night, towards 11 o'clock, they were awakened by the noise of a horse pulling up outside their door. The messenger begged Monsieur Bovary to come immediately to the farm of Les Berteaux to set a broken leg. The general practitioner, riding along, gathered from his guide's talk that Monsieur Rouault, who lived at Les Berteaux, must be one of the well-to-do farmers. He had broken his leg the evening before on his way home from a Twelfth Night feast at a neighbour's. His wife had been dead for 2 years. There was only his daughter, who helped him to keep house, with him. It was a substantial-looking farm. A young woman in a blue merino dress with three flounces came to the threshold of the door to receive Monsieur Bovary, whom she led into the kitchen, where a large fire was blazing. Charles went up to the first floor to see the patient. The fracture was a simple one, without any kind of complication. Charles could not have hoped for an easier case. Then, calling to mind the devices of his masters at the bedside of patients, he comforted the sufferer with all sorts of kindly remarks. The bandaging over, the doctor was invited by Monsieur Rouault himself to have a bit to eat before he left, downstairs with Mademoiselle Emma. Charles went down into the room on the ground floor. Knives and forks and silver goblets were laid for two on a little table. First they spoke of the patient, then of the weather, of the great cold, of the wolves that infested the fields at night. Mademoiselle Rouault did not like at all the country, especially now that she had to look after the farm almost alone. As the room was chilly, she shivered as she ate. This showed something of her full lips, that she had a habit of biting when silent. Her neck stood out from a white turned-down collar. Her hair, whose two black folds seemed each of a single piece, so smooth were they, was parted in the middle by a delicate line that curved slightly with the curve of the head. And just showing the tip of the ear, it was joined behind in a chic chignon, with a wavy movement at the temples that the country doctor saw now for the first time in his life. The upper part of her cheek was rose-coloured. When Charles, after bidding farewell to old Rouen, returned to the room before leaving, he found her standing, her forehead against the window, looking into the garden. She turned round.
"Are you looking for anything?" she asked.
"My whip, if you please," he answered. He began rummaging behind the doors, under the chairs. It had fallen to the ground. Mademoiselle Emma saw it and bent down for it. Charles, out of politeness, made a dash also, and as he stretched out his arm, at the same moment felt his breast brush against the back of the young girl bending beneath him. She drew herself up, scarlet, and looked at him over her shoulder as she handed him his whip. Instead of returning to Les Berteaux in 3 days, as he had promised, he went back the very next day, then regularly twice a week, without counting the visits he paid now and then as if by accident. Everything went well. The patient progressed favourably. Monsieur Bovary began to be looked upon as a man of great capacity. Old Rouen said he could not have been better cured by the first doctor of Yvetot, or even Rouen. As to Charles, he did not stay to ask himself why it was a pleasure to him to go to Les Berteaux. Had he done so, he would no doubt have attributed his zeal to the importance of the case, or perhaps to the money he hoped to make by it. Was it for this, however, that his visits to the farm formed a delightful exception to the meagre occupations of his life? On these days he rose early, set off at a gallop, urging on his horse, and then got down to wipe his boots in the grass and put on black gloves before entering. And when he left, Emma always reconducted him to the first step of the stairs. When his horse had not yet been brought round, she stayed there and had said goodbye. There was no more talking. The open air wrapped her round, playing with the soft down on the back of her neck. During the first period of Charles's visits, his wife never failed to inquire after the old invalid. But when she heard Monsieur Rouen had a daughter, she began to make inquiries, and she learned that Mademoiselle Rouen, brought up at the Ursuline convent, had received what is called a good education, and so knew dancing, geography, drawing, how to embroider, and play the piano. That was the last straw. "So it is for this," she said to herself, "that his face beams when he goes to see her, and that he puts on his new waistcoat at the risk of spoiling it with the rain. Ah, that woman!" And she detested her instinctively. At first she solaced herself by allusions that Charles did not understand, then by casual observations that he let pass for fear of a storm, finally by open apostrophes to which he knew not what to answer. Why did he go back to Les Berteaux now that Monsieur Rouen was cured and these folks hadn't paid yet? Ah, it was because a young lady was there, someone who knew how to talk, to embroider, to be witty. That was what he cared about. He wanted town misses. For very weariness, Charles left off going to Berteaux. His wife made him swear, his hand on the prayer book, that he would go there no more, after much sobbing and many kisses, in a great outburst of love. He obeyed then. But the strength of his desire protested against the servility of his conduct, and he thought with a kind of naive hypocrisy that this interdict to see her gave him a sort of right to love her. And then the widow was thin. She had long teeth, wore in all weathers a little black shawl, the edge of which hung down between her shoulder blades. Her bony figure was sheathed in her clothes as if they were a scabbard. They were too short, and displayed her ankles with the laces of her large boots crossed over grey stockings. In the spring, it came about that a notary at Ingouville, the holder of the widow's property, one fine day, went off taking with him all the money in his office. Monsieur Bovary, the elder, accused his wife of having caused the misfortune of their son by harnessing him to such a harridan, whose harness wasn't worth her hide. They came to Tostes. Explanations followed. There were scenes. Eloise, in tears, throwing her arms about her husband, conjured him to defend her from his parents. Charles tried to speak up for her. They grew angry and left the house. But the blow had struck home. A week after, as she was hanging up some washing in her yard, she was seized with a spitting of blood, and the next day, while Charles had his back turned to her, drawing the window curtain, she said, "Oh, God," gave a sigh and fainted. She was dead. What a surprise. When all was over at the ceremony, Charles went home. He went up to the first floor, to their room, saw her dress still hanging at the foot of the alcove. Then, leaning against the writing table, he stayed until the evening, buried in a sorrowful reverie.
She had loved him, after all. One morning, old Rouault brought Charles the money for setting his leg. 75 francs in 40 sous pieces, and a turkey. He had heard of his loss, and consoled him as well as he could. When, therefore, he perceived that Charles's cheeks grew red if near his daughter, which meant that he would propose to her one of these days, he chewed the cud of the matter beforehand. He certainly thought him a little meagre, and not quite the son-in-law he would have liked. But he was said to be well-conducted, economical, very learned, and no doubt would not make too many difficulties about the dowry. Now, as old Rouault would soon be forced to sell 22 acres of his property, as he owed a good deal to the mason, to the harness-maker, and as the shaft of the cider-press wanted renewing, "If he asks her," he said to himself, "I'll give her to him." At Michaelmas, Charles went to spend 3 days at Les Berteaux. The last day had passed like the others in procrastinating from hour to hour. Old Rouault was seeing him off. They were walking along the road full of ruts. They were about to part. This was the time. Charles gave himself as far as to the corner of the hedge, and at last, when past it, "Monsieur Rouault," he murmured, "I should like to say something to you." They stopped. Charles was silent. "Well, tell me your story. Don't I know all about it?" said old Rouault, laughing softly. The next day, by 9 o'clock, he was at the farm. Emma blushed as he entered and gave a little forced laugh to keep herself in countenance. Old Rouault embraced his future son-in-law. The discussion of money matters was put off. There was plenty of time before them, as the marriage could not decently take place till Charles was out of mourning, that is to say, about the spring of the next year. The winter passed waiting for this. Mademoiselle Rouault was busy with her trousseau. Part of it was ordered at Rouen, and she made herself chemises and nightcaps after fashion plates that she borrowed. When Charles visited the farmer, the preparations for the wedding were talked over. They wondered in what room they would have dinner. They dreamed of the number of dishes that would be wanted, and what should be the entrees. Emma would, on the contrary, have preferred to have a midnight wedding with torches, as was the local custom, but old Rouault could not understand such an idea. So there was a wedding at which 43 persons were present, at which they remained 16 hours at table, began again the next day, and to some extent on the days following. 2 days after the wedding, the married pair left. Charles, on account of his patients, could not be away longer. Monsieur and Madame Charles arrived at Tostes about 6 o'clock. The neighbours came to the windows to see their doctor's new wife. The old servant presented herself, curtsied, apologised for not having dinner ready, and suggested that Madame, in the meantime, should look over her house. Emma went upstairs. The first room was not furnished, but in the second, which was their bedroom, was a mahogany bedstead in an alcove with red drapery. A shell box adorned the chest of drawers, and on the secretary near the window, a bouquet of orange blossoms tied with white ribbons stood in a bottle. It was a bride's bouquet. It was the other one's. She looked at it. Charles noticed it. He took it and carried it up to the attic. While Emma, seated in an armchair, they were putting things down around her, thought of her bridal flowers packed up in a bandbox, and wondered, dreaming, what would be done with them if she were to die. During the first days, she occupied herself in thinking about changes in the house. She took the shades off the candlesticks, had new wallpaper put up, the staircase repainted, and seats made in the garden round the sundial. She even inquired how she could get a basin with jet fountains and fishes. Finally, her husband, knowing that she liked to drive out, picked up a second-hand dog cart, which, with new lamps and a splashboard in striped leather, looked almost like a tilbury. He was happy then, and without a care in the world. A meal together, a walk in the evening on the high road, a gesture of her hand over her hair, the sight of her straw hat hanging from the window fastener, and many another thing in which Charles had never dreamed of pleasure, now made up the endless round of his happiness.